today's speaker, who is Tom Heald. Tom is the managing partner for the Wyoming Plant Company, specializing in hardy native and adapted plants for Wyoming conditions. And as you all know, we throughout the interior west, we all share common conditions. So he'll have much to say that will be useful for the rest of us too. Previously, Tom was a Wyoming Extension educator for 26 years, where he worked with thousands of homeowners across the state who struggled to grow plants in this challenging environment. What he realized was that many times it was not the homeowner who was at fault for their plants not thriving, but it was the lack of appropriate plant materials to choose from. So he began to rethink suitable plants and landscaping, and he made a decision to leave the Extension Service and start his own nursery, and that's the Wyoming Plant Company. I really like this. He says that his goal is to provide education to his customers. There is a tremendous disconnect between people and their knowledge of plant materials, and we want to bridge that gap. So that's what he's going to do for us today. He wants to make you think and challenge conventional wisdom, and that's kind of what this whole series is about. So Tom is a great fit for it. And with that, Tom, I'd like to welcome you to join us to the talk today. How are you doing?
Oh, it's so good to be there. And I got to tell you, this is a new technology for me. I mean, I'm usually used to talking in front of audiences, and here I am at my kitchen table talking to you all. And I got to tell you, Ava, I'm still back on plant porn. I mean, I got to watch this guy next Thursday.
Yeah. Well, he's not actually the he is a super great local guy who does talks locally. He's not one of our featured speakers, but the kinds of things that he talks about, just showing people these amazing pictures of flowers that just kind of make you drool, is what I was referring to. Yeah.
Well, nonetheless.
Yes.
Hey, Ava, what I want to talk to everyone about today is kind of thinking about my 26 years as a county extension agent, you know, and I got to tell you, when I was a county agent, nobody ever called me up and says, "Man, Tom, come take a look at this beautiful plant," or "Come take a look at this beautiful yard." It just didn't happen. So I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the myths and realities when it comes to soils and lawns and trees and just planting in the West.
Great. That will be terrific. Would you start out by telling us first how you first got introduced to gardening or fell in love with it and where geographically that was?
Well, you know, you got to start off always as a child, and my childhood was in the Midwest. Anywhere I lived in Kansas and Iowa, and of course you put a seed in the ground and it grows. And that was pretty much fascination, but I got to tell you that as I went on to college and so forth, I actually became a pig behavioralist, of all things, okay?
Really?
Study of pigs, yeah, behavior. It had absolutely nothing to do with gardening. But what really tripped my trigger was when I became a county agent, no one could care less about what a pig was thinking. What they really cared about was what's wrong with my lawn.
Yeah, Tom, I can't believe
and
that
so
there's...
And so that became an interesting... What's that?
I'm sorry, I was just going to comment. I can't believe that you could specialize in pig behavior, actually. That's actually really interesting.
Well, yeah, it is. You know, funny thing, way back when, you know, in the time, I was studying aggression, okay?
Among pigs?
You don't think about... among pigs, but of all things, the research that funded... or the people that funded this research, was a Jewish outfit called Guggenheim Foundation. Their interest was, how does aggression get started in, like, say, soccer stadiums, you know, riots and so forth. And so they were using the pig as a model. All pretty interesting stuff.
Wow. Yeah, I'd say, actually. Okay, sorry to interrupt.
It has nothing to do with gardening.
So I interrupted you.
So with that, Yeah, with that, Ava, the thing that so I came to gardening actually with a fairly no experience, and yet as a county agent in the eyes of the people, man, I was the expert, and I didn't know what the first thing was first, and so it was incumbent on me to begin to understand processes, how the hip bone connects to the thigh bone, what makes sense and what doesn't. So I became a very good diagnostician, and so I was really good at figuring out what was wrong. But the harder part was figuring out what to do to correct it, and that's where I want to start with some things that we as a society are doing wrong. And I got to tell you, in the past couple of years, prior to leaving the Extension Service, we did our gardening program, and it was called Backyard Beginnings, and I marketed it as if you planted a zucchini seed, don't come to this class, okay? And what I found out was for 2 years running, we had 60 people a year sign up, pay $20 each, and it was from all walks of life. And what the take-home message to me was that folks, there was a disconnect between the natural world and their world. I would get questions like, you get soil from Walmart, right, Tom?
Really?
It was that kind of thing.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it really turned me around to think that we as a society perhaps have lost some of that kindred spirit in gardening. Mm-hmm. And again, we tend to do things what we think are right are typically wrong. And I want to start off with a question to you, Ava.
Sure.
Is if we think about soils, and everyone that's a gardener has to deal with soil at some point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And a myth that I'd like to throw out at you is rototilling good?
Is rototilling good? You know, This comes up. I do garden consulting locally here, and people want to rototill, and I discourage them because for a few reasons. One is because I know that it brings a lot of weed seeds to the surface and to light and gets them growing. And so the problem that people often think they're going to solve by rototilling, they actually make worse. It came up a little bit when we were talking to Bob Nold a week ago about soil structure, and so now I'm not quite sure where I stand on that, but I had thought that soil structure was a really important thing and that you don't want to just churn it all up. So that's my impression thus far.
Yep, and you're spot on, but yet as gardeners, most of us own a rototiller. I do not. And that whole idea of soil structure, and just kind of give you an idea of what soil structure is. Let's use a cake as an analogy. You know, if you think about, you bake a cake, and inside that cake are a lot of air pockets, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you put that cake into a food processor and turn it all up, what do you got?
Slime.
It's no longer a cake. Yeah, it's no longer a cake.
Yeah.
And so what rototilling does is destroy soil structure, okay? And you've all seen it. Your soils, you know, you get out there and you rototill and rototill and rototill, and then it rains and you see that the soil collapses on top of each other. Now, the first fundamental rule is for plants, plant roots need as much oxygen as they do water, okay? And so if you destroy all the pores in the soil by rototilling, you destroy the ability of that garden to support the below-ground roots. So, absolutely not. Rototilling has morphed from a cultivation, you know, taking just simply go an inch or two on top of the surface to destroy the weeds,
mm-hmm.
to mixing it all up. And, you know, in nature, it takes about a year for the freeze-thaw cycle to recreate soil structure.
Hmm.
So, absolutely not. Myth. That's a myth that just, you know, if all things considered, sell your rototiller. You're going to be a happier person.
Great. Yeah, that's definitely good advice. While we're talking about soil real quick, will you tell us about your native soil, where you garden personally, and your elevation?
Sure. I'm from Casper, Wyoming, and that's in the central part of the state. Typically, our pH of our soils are around 8. Now, we have two types of soils here, and neither of the two show. We either got sand or we either got clay, mm-hmm. and neither of the two. I garden on sand, mm-hmm. But most of people in Wyoming and Casper garden on clay.
And your elevation?
The other thing that I wanted to say, the elevation is 5,200.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, go ahead.
The other myth that I wanted to bring out was whatever you hear from a East Coast garden television show, do the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you hear from the East Coast, do the exact opposite. Let me give you an example. You know, the Victory Gardens, you know, established out on the East Coast, oftentimes talks about putting wood ash into the soil and incorporating it. That's fine if you live in Vermont with a pH of 5, but where most of us in the interior west have pHs that are more alkaline, above 7 in other words, that's a bad thing because wood ash has a pH of about 11. So we're making a alkaline soil even more alkaline. In Vermont, we're raising the pH to about neutral, to 7. So that's something that I would have people not do is put wood ash into their gardens. It's fundamentally wrong for Western soils.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
You know, and the other thing is that sometimes you might hear a recommendation, you know, if you been working around metal and you have all these filings, put them out in the soil. It's good for the soil. And that's not really true for Western soils. Because our pH is fairly high, iron gets bound up in the soil and becomes unavailable to plants. Whereas in, say, Vermont, with that pH being very low, it's almost immediately available. So just things like that that, you know, just avoid. Now, the other thing about wood ash, you know, if you're got an alley and full of weeds, that's the place to put wood ash because it'll actually act as a soil sterilant. Then I throw up, you know, we in the West use a lot of gypsum, and we're using it inappropriately. The thought is that gypsum breaks up clay. It doesn't break up clay. What gypsum does is if you have a high salt content, it'll help remove the salt, but not clay. And then I throw in a few other things about soils. You know, if you've got clay soils, the last thing you want to do is put sand in it, and I'll tell you why. It'll form concrete. Okay? Some other things that we do, eggshells. Is that good or bad? It's neither. Eggshells put in the soil here adds calcium. Most of our soils in the West already have plenty of calcium. Now, the good thing is that calcium is not toxic. So if you're putting eggshells in your garden, keep doing it. Not going to hurt.
Mm-hmm. And you can put eggshells in your compost, too, if you compost, right?
Absolutely. You know, probably another great little secret that doesn't get used much is, you know, you've got all these coffee houses like Starbucks and, you know, the local, you know, they have pound upon pound of used coffee grounds that could be utilized in a compost pile and would provide some acidity to our soils.
Mm-hmm.
And it's free.
There's actually one in town here that saves it up and bags it even for people to come and take. It's pretty cool. There used to be, I think that one got bought by another one, but anyway, it's cool, yeah.
Yeah, Yeah, but when you think, you know, that's Durango, but as we think about the entire interior Rocky Mountain West, there's a lot of small towns that just aren't utilizing those coffee grounds the way they could.
Absolutely.
And then I got to tell you one last thing about soils that I think have some merit. You know, I mentioned that I grew up in Kansas and Iowa, and, you know, Iowa is the breadbasket of the United States. You know, Iowa soils didn't become Iowa soils because Iowa farmers farmed it. It was because of the tall grass prairie growing and, more importantly, dying. That dying process over tens of thousands of years created that 20 feet of topsoil, 5% organic matter. If we look at our native soils in the Rocky Mountain West, they are 0% organic matter. So if you're ever going to fix a clay soil, add organic matter. If you're ever going to fix a sandy soil, add organic matter. I can't tell you that much, you know. So as we think about improving soils, it's organic matter. It's grass clippings. It's leaves. It's compost. Whatever you can do to put into the soil, you're going to improve the organic content, and hence you're going to improve the ability of plants to live.
But, Tom, what about native plants or adapted plants from other steppe regions in the world, for example, that grow in these kinds of conditions already? They grow in clay soils, or they grow in sandy soils.
Yeah. Bingo. That's the other half. If these native and adapted steppe plants that have evolved under low organic content soils, they simply don't need the organic matter. In fact, they don't do well with high organic content soils. But as I think about people and their lawns and their trees and all that, that's a different story than, say, a complete garden that specializes in xeric plant material.
Mm-hmm.
Xerics don't want to be fertilized, they don't want to be watered, and they don't want their soils amended. It's a great way to kill them.
So that would fit into our last two talks where both Mike and Bob talked about dry land gardening, and that would be those plants that don't want the extra, any extras at all, really. So.
No, I mean, I can tell you, I've played around with some of the xerics, you know, and I've put down wood mulches and rock mulches, and I can tell you the xeric plant materials just despise the wood mulch and perform so much better with just inorganic rock mulch as a surface coating.
Mm-hmm. And can you say a little bit about why that is, how the plant knows what's going on top of the soil?
One of the things that as we think about plants and we think about soil microbes,
mm-hmm.
One thing is certain. The soil microbes have a job to do, and that is to break down the organic content. And they're very efficient at doing that, so efficient that they're able to take nutrients away from plants before they can use it to break down the organic compounds. And so what happens is that plants go into a stress, if you will, because they're not getting the appropriate nutrients. And you think about a xeric plant that has never had organics in their life. They have evolved with the whole idea that they don't need organics and that the soil microorganisms aren't taking it away from their availability. So if we're thinking about xerics, don't add organic material. But if you're thinking about a vegetable garden, by all means. That makes a lot of sense in my mind.
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned bark mulch on the surface of the soil as opposed to gravel
yes.
mulch. So also more dryland xeric plants, they do better with the gravel than the...
They fundamentally do.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to change, just since we're there, We need to talk about trees a little bit, because trees are a part of the American West, and it's certainly a part of everyone's landscape.
Great.
Some fundamental things we got to know about trees.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about where trees grow, they grow in forests. Now, I want to put you, you're now walking on the forest floor. And I don't care if it's in Durango or in New Jersey, you're walking on the forest floor. What are you walking on?
Tree debris.
Yeah. Yes, tree debris, tree duff.
Mm-hmm.
And that tree duff, by the way, is fundamentally important for the survival of trees. That tree duff holds certain fungi called mycorrhizae fungi. And this fungi actually forms a symbiotic relationship with the tree. In other words, it grabs onto the root hairs. And in exchange for a little food for the from the tree, the fungi actually break down nutrients and increase water capabilities up into the roots. So it's a symbiotic relationship. The thing that I really want to take home is grasses and trees don't mix. They never have, not in nature. Not in nature. And the cool thing is that I was, as a county agent, I was reading a research report where a soil scientist went out into the forest, took soil samples, took it back to the lab, and said, okay, what kind of microorganisms are found in the forest ecosystems? And it was almost all fungi related because of the high carbon. Then he did the exact same thing, went out to the prairie, took the soil samples, came back, and it was almost all bacterial in nature. So grasses evolved with the soils of bacteria. Trees evolve with the soils with fungi. And so we put trees in a sea of grass, typically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably one of the worst things you can do to a young tree. And so a lot of times what I tell folks to do is, okay, you got this huge lawn. I want you to take out at least 5 feet around the tree and replace it with wood mulch. We want to create the conditions for good tree growth. And we do that simply by adding that wood mulch.
So that's creating the tree well,
yes.
Basically, right? And so that's a good reason to do that, along with avoiding mower and weed whacker scars.
Yeah, you know, I can't tell you how I am a certified arborist, and I can't tell you how many times I see trees being weed whacked.
Mm-hmm.
And what you got to know about tree biology is this: life exists in the first inch or two of that tree. And so every time you weed whack it, you're destroying its ability to move nutrients up and down the tree. So that, again, another reason to have a mulched area around your trees. You know, pretty hard to weed whack the grass right up to the tree.
Sure.
So that's something that I would highly encourage everyone to do, is consider grasses and trees don't mix. So what we're going to do is separate the two.
Great.
You know, I want to throw out this, since we're just on trees, and I want you to wrap your head around this. A mature tree, let's say what's pretty common in the West is a cottonwood tree. Let's say it's 50 feet tall. We now know that root system extends 3 to 7 times the height of that tree outward. Okay, so a 50-foot tree has a root system of up to 350 feet away from it.
Wow,
okay?
I'd heard
chances
2 to 3.
Are.
That's amazing that they found it can be 7 times as much now. It's incredible.
Yes, 7 times.
Yeah.
And the thing that I want to say to you is if you're living in town, chances are likely you're watering your neighbor's trees and they're watering yours. Okay? And the other cool thing, life exists in the first 12 inches of the soil. Life exists in the first 12 inches. In other words, those roots of that tree and most of our plants are found only in the first 12 inches of the soil. So fundamentally, there's absolutely no reason that when you irrigate that you have to go beyond 12 inches. into the soil profile.
Now, can I ask you real quick, what about how I've always heard, probably many of us have heard, you got to water deep to establish your plant because you want the roots to grow, any kind of plant, because you want the roots to go down deep where they can get their own water and are not so reliant on us. That's totally just bunk.
That is totally debunked. You know, there are a few xeric plants, you know, like in our Western landscapes. I can think of rabbit brush and sagebrush that have a two-tiered root system, one that's very close to the surface of the soil and another tier that goes deep and does mine extra moisture. But the fact of the matter is root development is limited by the amount of oxygen in the soil. Root development is limited by the amount of oxygen in the soil. In other words, roots need oxygen as much as they need water. And we find the highest concentrations of oxygen in that first 12 inches. Do not assume for a minute that trees will grow deep roots. They simply don't. And I would challenge you, as we've walked in the forest, on those trails, what are you always tripping on?
Roots.
Roots that are on the surface of the soil. If we were to go into the forest with a high-powered blower and blow all the tree duff away, we would find the roots directly on the surface soil. Deep means different things. But for us, I want you to think in terms of the first 12 inches. Beyond that, roots can't survive very well because of the lack of oxygen. So we can throw away the deep root water.
Yeah, I guess so.
We can also throw away the deep root fertilizer. Mm. There is no roots down there. Mm-hmm. The most active ones are very close to the surface of the soil. Mm-hmm. So,
thanks for clearing
that. So those are the kind of things that I'm thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
You know, and the other thing, Ava, that I think about is we look across the interior West, you know, as we talk about subjects of, like, say, our carbon footprint, mm-hmm. I would contend that in the American West, our biggest issue is not the carbon footprint, but our water footprint. Mm-hmm. You know, typically, a Kentucky bluegrass lawn, which most of us do have, supplemental water ranges from 30 to 40 inches of supplemental water every year. And so Kentucky bluegrass lawns are our biggest water hogs. I want you to imagine the town of Durango as a swimming pool, that you could literally swim across it if you had 30 to 40 inches of precipitation applied to the Kentucky bluegrass.
Mhm. I want to ask you something about that, but I'm wondering if you might be going there anyway.
Yeah. Ask away, girl.
Okay. Well, when I took the Master Gardener course here locally, they talked about the Kentucky bluegrass, and they talked about how people overwater it. We give it way more water than what it actually needs. And that it, what was it? I think during some of the more extreme drought years we've experienced, they realized that it would turn brown, but it didn't die like some of the other grasses that were supposedly more water efficient. And so it sounded to me like the conclusion is that it's a people problem, not a plant problem. We want to water the grass way more than it needs to do its thing. And some of that, well, I'll let you talk more about that. What do you think about that?
Yeah. We're spot on. And I can tell you that there is no plant that has evolved under every other day irrigation. You know, plants never evolved that way.
Uh-huh.
They don't need it. And if we go back to this 12-inch rule, okay, I want to tell you how to irrigate. And this is probably worthwhile for folks to write down because you probably have never heard this before. When it's time to irrigate, okay, I want you to have your lawn go into drought stress. By that, I mean when you walk across it, the grass doesn't spring back. It's time to irrigate. Only this time, I want you to irrigate for 15 minutes, and you're going to time it. You're going to record that time. Now, your soil is different than my soil. So the point being is you may have clay, I may have sand, so we're different. After 15 minutes, I want you to go out and dig a plug out of the soil, out of the lawn, and see how far the water traveled into the soil. And we're trying to get to 12 inches. You know, say you did it in 15 minutes and you went 3 inches, you know that you got to keep adding more water, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Until that time, you get to 12 inches. Once you record that time will never change. I always irrigate for, you know, let's say 25 minutes, whatever that time is to get 12 inches.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does change is the frequency. Obviously, in the spring of the year when it's cool, you could probably get by with every 7 to 14-day waterings. Now, fast forward this to summer. It's 95 degrees, 5% relative humidity, and a 20-mile breeze. Okay? It's changed. Now you're probably talking about once every 4th to 5th day irrigation. But you always water for the same amount of time.
And then you always are waiting until your lawn shows some stress. That's the assumption, right?
Just a little bit of stress. I mean, we're not talking about browning out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you limit your watering, the cool thing is that all of the diseases that affect lawns go away. Because lawn diseases must have very moist conditions. If all of a sudden it's like a big thunderstorm comes. You put a big chunk of water down and then you don't. Put a big chunk of water down and you don't. The disease organisms simply go away. They don't like those conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But the great thing is when you think about grasses and roots of trees, they're all in that first 12 inches. You're going to improve the overall health of your landscape just by deep but infrequent waterings.
Excellent. So when you say deep, though, just to clarify, because we were just talking about that, deep means only to the first 12 inches. You don't
right.
mean deeper than that.
Right.
So, okay. Just want to...
Not deeper than that because life exists mm-hmm. only in that first 12 inches.
Yeah.
Now, you know, don't get me wrong. We've all excavated and found roots deeper than that. But the most active, viable roots are in that first 12 inches.
Right. Great.
And that is for sure a take-home.
Yeah.
Can
I ask you a tree watering?
Where are we at on time? What's that?
We have 20 minutes to a half an hour left. And I wonder how you're feeling about time because I'm wanting to ask you a question about watering trees.
Yeah?
Yes,
okay.
Please do. So you mentioned how far out the roots spread and that we're watering our neighbor's trees and they're watering ours. So got that. How do we properly water our trees? Then, with the roots going so far, what makes sense?
Well, one of the things that I would say to you, let's look at the tree canopy for a second. Whether it's an evergreen or a deciduous tree, when you stand under the tree during a rainstorm, you're not really getting wet, are you?
Right, not for a while.
And so what I would have people do is use the essentially the drip line out as irrigation. So you don't need to water at the base of the tree. I'm less concerned about that as I am just going out expansively.
Hmm.
So from the drip line out.
Well, that sounds like another myth you've just debunked because I always thought you were supposed to water from the drip line in toward the trunk.
Well, if you know, what we now know is that the roots of trees grow 3 to 7 times away, the height of the tree away.
Right.
In all directions.
Right.
And so You know, those big old spruce trees, you know, that really nothing wants to live underneath them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the roots of those trees aren't really there either. They're extended far, far out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes little sense, if you think about it, to have a drip irrigation system on a tree.
Yeah.
Knowing what a root system is going to do, a drip isn't the answer. And, you know, and some of the other things that I see people do is, you know, watering their evergreens, their needles.
Oh.
I guarantee you the or putting muir acid, you know, on the evergreens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fundamentally, these guys are xeric plants that aren't going to take up water, and they're certainly not going to take up nutrients through their needles.
Right.
You know, so you're much better off when we think about watering and fertilizing. Think further away from the tree. Think further away.
Great. That's really helpful to know. And since you mentioned evergreen leaves, I just want to real quickly have you debunk one more myth about the acidity in conifer needles as far as how it affects the soil. I know people get concerned about their soil being too acidic because of that, because of the needles dropping. And my understanding is that's just not true.
No, in a sense, we have to think about it in terms of an ocean. You know, if we're not going to change the ocean's salty water by adding more water, fresh water to it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is going to want to come back to normal. And that's true even in our soils. If it's a pH of 8, it still wants to be a pH of 8. Once you get up into the mountains, where tens of thousands of years of the evergreen forest dropping its needles, yeah, we do have pHs that are lower than in the valleys. What does happen underneath trees is the lack of sunlight and the pine needles do create conditions for plants not wanting to grow very well underneath the tree. And that's a tree's defense system, you know. If he can defend himself from keeping other plants from growing around him, he's better to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we don't have much success underneath our large evergreens trying to grow things.
Great, thanks. Okay, what do you have for us next, Tom?
We talked a little bit about trees. I want to say to you, what makes manures hot, Ava? You know, we're as gardeners, we're always throwing, always adding organic matter and stuff like that into the garden. But what makes manures hot?
Well,
where'd that term come from?
Nitrogen. I think there may be some microbial component that adds to the heat, but I would say nitrogen first and foremost.
Well, you're partly right.
Okay.
Manures, if you think about it, are waste products, obviously. And so, you know, we always talk about not using fresh manures.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why is that nitrogen is bound up in salt. Okay? It's a waste product. Salt's a waste product. And nitrogen's bound up in it. It's not the nitrogen that makes it hot. It's the salt. And as you know, salts burn plants. So it is the salt content in manure that is really the culprit when it comes to hot manures. So you've always heard use aged manures. The reason for that is you flush the salts away over time. And so that's something I just wanted to throw out.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I do have one last thing on this, and I want to get to our slideshow. Something about fertilizer. Question, is compost a good fertilizer? Is compost a good fertilizer?
Are you wanting me to
answer
that?
Really, if you want to.
I'll let you do it.
Okay. You know, this is where we tend to do good things for the wrong reasons. Compost is a very poor fertilizer. What it does do is add to the soil's condition, but it has very little nitrogen. You know, when nitrogen, phosphorus, or potassium, it has very low amounts. So if you want to fertilize and you're thinking of saying, well, I'll just put some compost down, it may not be enough. It may not be enough. And then the last thing on fertilizers, you know, which is better, man-made or organic fertilizer? Which is better?
I'm always of the organic persuasion myself.
Okay, and I'm okay with that. But at the end of the day, the plant doesn't care.
Mm.
Okay, it's the human that cares. In other words, there's only one form of nitrogen that the plant recognizes. And it takes a long time with organic fertilizers to break down to where that molecule of nitrogen is available to the plant, where man-made is almost immediately available. So the nice thing about organic fertilizers is that they add organic matter along with the fertilizing attributes. But I can tell you that the plant doesn't care.
But I thought
they're looking for that night.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I thought that one of the reasons to use organic fertilizers was because the soil cares, because it helps. It does. It's just better somehow. I forget all the details now, but there are micronutrients more likely to be in organic fertilizers, which are good for soil building and then ultimately for the plant.
Yeah, touche, well said. As we add organic content, we create livable spaces for microbes to do their thing and also provide those micronutrients.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what the plant cares about, it cares about that individual molecule when it becomes available.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my only point is, typically, if I use man-made stuff, I always like to use a what's called a slow-release fertilizer. I don't want mm-hmm. it all available all at once. And organic is naturally slow.
Mm-hmm.
You could apply that in April, and it might be available to the plant in August.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the ultimate slow-release.
Because when you add the human-made stuff, that is just kind of chemicals like Miracle-Gro. It's the analogies I've heard is that it's like crack for the plant. It sucks it all up right away, like you said, and then it's gone. And it needs it again to keep the process going if you want it
yep.
to keep showing the results.
And, that's a really good analogy. I always thought of it as kind of a nicotine hit, you know.
Uh-huh.
You're given a big dose of nitrogen, and then it's gone.
Right.
And that's what the miracle grows do, is that they're almost immediate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the last myth, last one.
Wait, I have another fertilizer question.
Okay.
Sorry, I keep holding you up. But I just want to bring it back to the whole mission of this series and ask if we are growing adapted and native plants, do we need to be using fertilizers of any kind?
Very, very little. Very, very little. If I'm going to couch this, the highly xeric plants don't know how to respond to high nutrients
mm-hmm.
and high nitrogen, primarily nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can really mess up their systems by putting fertilizers down. On the other hand, things that have evolved, for example, from the tall grass prairies, could stand just a little bit of nitrogen or fertilizer
mm-hmm.
for a short period of time just to get their roots going and all that business.
Go ahead.
No, you, best way what?
Sorry. Is the best way to know which plants we should be fertilizing and which don't need it, is the best way to know that by just observation? Is there some way that we can tell by looking, or is it more a matter of study and knowing where our plants come from, if they come from the tall grass prairie or if they come from this or that environment naturally?
Yeah, I think it has more. I want you to guide yourself more as to where was this plant originally found.
Okay.
If we talk about Panayotis Kalaitis talks on where he finds plants high up on the African hillsides, South African hillsides, you know, those plants really never evolved under a high nitrogen soil. Mm-hmm. But if we think about purple coneflower, echinacea, that is a tall grass prairie plant, you know, chances are they could stand a little bit of fertilizer, not much, but a little bit, to help them get going. And if you're planting plants from the interior west who have never seen man-made fertilizer and really don't really know what fertilizer is about, period, chances are they're not going to want any fertilizer at all.
Great.
Now, all things considered, my last myth is fertilizer plant food. Is fertilizer plant food? And we all learned this in the fifth grade, by the way. It's not. No matter how much fertilizer companies want to tell you fertilizer is plant food, it is not. Photosynthesis, the conversion of sunlight through chlorophyll, makes plant food. That is plant food, sunlight. And so fertilizers have nothing to do with making plant food.
Very good to know. Nice to be
clear. Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
So I probably got everybody confused. Didn't mean to do that, but
no, you did great.
At least hopefully there's some ideas for thought. If people have a chance to get onto their computers, I think we can switch gears a little bit.
Great.
Now, Ava, most are people listening on telephones, or they got a computer in front of them? What's typically happening?
You know, I can find out. And more by phone, it looks like right now, but they will be able to tune in for the next 24 hours, and so then who knows?
Okay. Well, I wanted to just show you some photos, and. You know, Wyoming, one of the things about Wyoming, at least on the eastern side of the state, you never hear about the hurricanes in Wyoming, but yet we get hurricane winds consistently and primarily through the winter months. I'm talking 75, 85 mile an hour winds. And so one of the things that you asked me to do is talk about some plant strategies that deal with wind. And the first slide I have here is just a picture of me with a couple of colleagues, and we're looking at some plants from the Cheyenne Horticultural Field Station. So no great shakes there. Okay, I'm going to move on to the next slide. One thing that you talked to me about was how do you plant on hillsides? And this is a description of a tree planted on a hillside, but a perennial plant on a hillside, it still holds true. And you can see the first one where we're burying the trunk of the tree or burying the trunk of the plant in the hillside, we're actually going to kill that plant. And so what I like to see is you can see how we excavated either up or down into the hillside and planted. And you can see where the base of it is. What I like about these strategies is that, as we all know, hillsides, water runs off very fastly. So if we can cut into it to plant, we create little places where water can hold for a little bit.
I have a really steep slope behind my house I've been working on for the 7 years I've lived here, and it's much steeper than in this slide. And I have actually dug a little well in that uphill side that's level to help make a reservoir so that when I water, it can have a chance to actually sink down into the roots, because since it's on the uphill side, I figure that will help and get it to the roots. Do you think that is a good method? It made sense to me, but I don't know.
It's a great strategy. The whole idea is not to plant deeper than what it grew at, but because it's so steep, that water runs off, so cutting into the hillside allows for the water to pool up before it runs down. And so, you're doing it right on.
Great. Thanks. Yeah, when I climb around up there trying to do all this stuff, I call it extreme gardening. My husband doesn't let me do it when he's gone, just in case I fell. It's really kind of treacherous, but I'm sure I'm not the only one who goes through those kinds of maneuvers. West with our mountains is good for that, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay, let's we'll move on because we've only got a few more minutes.
Yep.
Now, again, this is a photo of a tree planting, but this holds true for all plants. I want everybody to dig the hole twice as wide as the plant itself, twice as wide. And the reason why is that we're going to allow those roots to escape horizontally out into the soil. And so we're digging it, and then we'll just move on. Okay? And we're only going to plant the plant never deeper than what it was grown at in the nursery. If anything, plant it shallower. This is true for perennials, grasses, trees, anything that you're going to get. Don't plant it deeper than what it was grown at. So we want a wide, but not a very deep hole. Okay, we'll move right on. And now here's a technique. You can see where that shovel's kind of horizontal, cutting into the hills, into the hole. If you have really clay soils, that's a great technique. The more surface area you can create, the better it's going to be. You know that clays really create that shiny
mm-hmm.
surface,
mm-hmm.
you know, when they're cut into.
Yeah.
Well, over time, that could literally become almost a bowl where roots can't even penetrate it. So doing slices vertically into the sides of the planting hole is a good thing, particularly if you live on clay. Okay, next one is cutting roots. Now, most sage gardeners know that they're going to have to cut roots, whether this be a tree or a perennial. But the point that I want to make to you is that people are going to spend big bucks on a tree, and then the nursery owner tells you to cut the roots. And I'm saying about an inch deep, four or five locations around the root ball. And the reason being is if you don't cut them, the roots will continue to grow in that circular fashion. And within about 5 years' time, you'll have a dead tree. And when you bring it up, all the roots will be just circling themselves and basically strangled itself. So where you make the cuts is where the new root hairs will begin to grow out. So always, always, always cut the roots. Okay, and then the next slide just simply shows you the plant in its place. Notice that the hole is not deeper than the surrounding area. And really, the plant has to live in the soil provided, so we're not adding any amendments to the soil.
Great. I think that's a common misunderstanding or more myth or just old information, that you really need to amend the soil. So I'm glad you pointed that out.
Yeah, you don't need to. It's got to live there. And because we've got a picture of a tree, I'll go back to that 3 to 7 times away from the height of the tree out. So in other words, it has to live in that native soil. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. And so it's foolish to even amend the potting where the plant's going to be planted. Then the last thing is that we often, particularly trees, I call it bondage. We tie trees up. And we don't need to. One of the things that I always do is, you can see where the woman's holding the trunk of the tree. I want you to move the trunk of the tree, and basically I want to look down at the soil. If the root ball is intact and not moving, you don't need to stake a tree. Okay? If it does move, that's the only time you stake it, and you only stake it for about 6 months and take the tree down. Tree stakes down. Okay. Now we're going to move on to probably where I really wanted to be in the first place. This is a setting on South Pass in Wyoming. The elevation is about 7,800 feet. It's a beautiful October morning, and I'm on the Mormon Trail. And I want you to look at the ecosystem there and look at the spacing of the plants. And that's what I find so beautiful about the West is how things want to evolve under and very large spaces. You're never walking on a particular plant on every footstep that you take. And the next slide shows, again, more of a steppe country. This, in particular, is around Du Bois, Wyoming. And there's lots of rocks in the environment. And I think we sometimes don't use rocks much, but we should. We're going to move on. This is a picture. This is a desert setting where you can see that this is just really clay, really crappy soils. And yet there's life out there, not only living but thriving. This is in the red desert of Wyoming, and that bluish flower that you see is a penstemon. Okay, this is an area that typically can get anywhere from 80 to 90 mile an hour winds. And one of the plant strategies that I wanted to throw at you is I want you to look at that thick, waxy leaf on that penstemon. Its sole objective is to keep water from being lost through its leaf. And so thick, waxy leaves do that. Okay. Again, another really steppe plant is saltbush. This is a female, and it's in the fall of the year. You can see kind of the seed heads turning that burgundy color. The thing that I want to mention to you is almost entirely, when we think about high wind and high solar activity, we have very small leaves on our plants, exclusively small leaves. Okay, keep moving. Okay, we're looking at Wyoming big sagebrush. Ava, what color would you describe that as?
I would consider it sage green, as a matter of fact. And we're on slide 14, just
okay.
In case anyone got lost there. Yeah, sage green.
Yep, thank you. Yep. Okay, sage green, but it has that silvery color to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, I say that there's a silver blue to green silver, okay, color that is prominent throughout the West. And that color, the interesting thing about it is it's the most efficient color in the plant kingdom at dissipating heat. And that's why sagebrush out in that intense sunlight can withstand it, is because the color of that plant diffuses heat the most efficiently. We're going to move on to the next slide. Okay. Now, here we are at somebody's house, and by the way, I took this picture at about 10 o'clock in the morning. It was well over 100 degrees.
Wow.
And you can see that color coming out, that silver blue, that white, you know, silver green color. It can withstand the most heat. And I know that you had several folks talking about plant select plants, and there's a couple of them in here that are really good. Seafoam artemisia is up towards the top of the mound, and then right next to it is partridge feather. Again, these colors and the rocks in the environment really set this place off, and you can tell that they're really, really happy plants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the partridge feather is closer in the foreground, and the seafoam artemisia is like on the corner of the house.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. The other strategy, you know, this is a plant select plant. We're on slide 16 now. And this is, I forget if it's Turkish Veronica or Crystal
so.
Rivers. I think it's Crystal Rivers. But, you know, the first thing that captures you is that intense color of the flower. But down below, laying low to the ground, are these thick, waxy leaves that can withstand the high winds and the intense sunlight. Okay, on to 17, and here we have ice plants. I know Paniotti talked a lot about ice plants, that you know, their evolution from South Africa, but you can see that these succulents that hold their water around waxy leaves, again, really want to hold on to water. And then the next slide. the thing that captures my mind is this is pine needle penstemon or pine leaf penstemon. Penstemons are native to the American West. If we could zero in on that photo, you would see tiny, tiny leaves. And in the background is blue oak grass, and again, that color that I've been talking about. These are all plants that want to do well under intense sunlight and high wind. The other thing I want to make a point to is look at the spacing between plants. This is a landscape that gets watered six times a year. And it's doing just fine. I'm going to jump around a little bit. We're looking at New Mexico privet, a vastly underutilized shrub in the American West. This one, and if you look directly into it, you might see what looks like a white-haired man standing behind there. But look at that leaf structure of this New Mexico privet. This doesn't get irrigated at all. And the next slide is another picture of New Mexico privet under Kentucky bluegrass lawn. So it can survive moisture, but it does very well with no moisture. Small leaves rule. Mm-hmm. Okay, next slide is antelope bitterbrush on a hillside native, just natively living. And we'll flip again. And I want you to look. This is a native of the West. Its Latin name is Persia tridentata. And you can see the beautiful flowers. But again, if there's a take-home message when it comes to high wind and high intensity and low water, it is small, waxy leaves. Again, the whole idea of this plant is to keep water in its place. And it's quite beautiful plant, native plant. And then I have one last slide that I think is a tribute to the American West. This is curl-leaf mountain mahogany. It's a deciduous evergreen. And when you look at this photo, you know, what comes to my mind is what Japanese bonsai gardener wouldn't pay, you know, $20,000 for something like this. And as you look around the entire photo and you see all these green spots, that is all curl-leaf mountain mahogany growing, except this guy's all by himself. And I'm estimating that this plant that we're looking at is anywhere from 1 to 3,000 years of age.
You're kidding. How tall is it?
No, not in the least.
How tall is that one?
It may be 15 feet tall. And try to imagine that the eons of antelope and deer and elk and domestic cows and sheep browsing on that guy. And you know, PK talks about using curl-leaf mountain mahogany as a dry land formal hedge. Because it doesn't need much water, and when you trim it with a formal hedge, it gets denser. It's like being browsed. Now, curl-leaf mountain mahogany doesn't lose its leaves in the wintertime. It's a deciduous evergreen, but very, very drought tolerant.
Wait, did you say it doesn't lose its leaves?
Pardon me?
Did you say it does not lose its leaves?
It does not lose.
So
rarely does it lose its leaves in the wintertime.
So it wouldn't be...
Most times it's evergreen.
So it's not deciduous, you said.
It is deciduous. It's a deciduous evergreen.
I thought deciduous...
It can lose its leaves.
It can lose them, but it doesn't. I just want to make sure we're
so,
clear here.
Yeah, no, in the wintertime, it very well may retain its green leaves.
Huh, okay. Great.
Okay.
Well, yeah, it sure is beautiful. I've seen that plant when it's much younger and never seen it have that sort of bonsai-esque form, but it is very captivating. As Bob Noble described the interior West and its native plants, evocative. This is definitely an evocative specimen right here, so thanks for sharing that with us.
You bet. And I tend to think that we're over our time frame, Ava.
Oh, we're right.
So I think I better end it here.
Okay. Yeah, that's perfect timing.
Well, however you want to do that.
Yeah, no, we're good.
So
thank you so much for joining us today, Tom. I think that you have really hit the nail on the head numerous times as far as the myths that you have addressed and just clarifying a lot of different concepts and ideas that all of us have heard some things about or maybe conflicting information, but really drove home some really useful points. So thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. I really enjoyed it, and good luck, Ava, with this whole project. I want to really give you kudos for doing this. This is a first for me, and quite honestly, it's got to be nice for all the these great speakers to talk to, all across the West at one time. What a great thing you did.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. I appreciate that. It's been fun, and it is exciting to get this kind of information out to such a broad audience all at once while we both sit at our home offices or wherever we're at. So,
yeah.
Well, thank you again, and I'll just wrap up the session by telling people what to expect with our next speaker. So thanks again, Tom.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye.